You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of February 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, as barbs fly over who might replace Justice Scalia, some are calling it a constitutional crisis.
And once you set the date, when you're president, will you abide by that date?
Well, we have 80 years of precedent of not confirming Supreme Court justices in an election year.
Plus, Donald Trump adds 9/11 and the Iraq War to his list of political weaponry in response to rival White House hopeful Jeb Bush taking to the stage with his brother.
George Bush made a mistake. We can make mistakes, but that one was a beauty. We should have never been in Iraq. We have destabilized the Middle East.
We'll also be looking ahead to this week's European Union Leaders Summit. That's all ahead here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to today's programme. My guests today are Michael Binion, Foreign Affairs Specialist for The Times here in London, and the author and commentator Geoffrey Kaufman. Welcome both to the show. Good to have you with us. We'll start today with a topic what just about every American political commentator, and quite a few without as well, has already weighed in on. Almost as soon as the first obituaries for Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia went to print, most presidential candidates were climbing over each other to get their message heard. Obama holds the constitutional right, constitutional responsibility, some would say, to make an appointment, but it's an election year, and with less than 12 months left of his presidency, the Republican Party has uncharacteristically banded together to question the president's right to appoint Scalia's replacement. Geoffrey, we'll start with you, a veteran of this scene, of course. The Senate is, I don't know, to say likely, it could well fail to approve Obama's appointment if indeed he does name somebody. How's this going to play out, do you think?
Can I just step back for a moment? This is extraordinary. We have the most compelling American election imaginable with these larger-than-life outrageous characters running for the Republican nomination, and it is utterly compelling. And now this, when this happened over the weekend, it was, you know, you take all of those American reality shows and then you throw in the death of the most conservative justice on the court just to add to the vitriol. And you have now, I mean, it's over for 2016. This is the only story. It is so compelling. It is so interesting. And unlike reality TV, so much is at stake. Mm. It really is fascinating to watch. I think depending on your politics, if you're from a very conservative bent in America, you're thrilled with this. If you're not, you're despairing.
Michael, what do you make of it then? I suppose before we talk about the constitutional ins and outs, do you sort of agree with Geoffrey on this?
Well,
is it extra spice to something
yes.
that almost didn't need it?
I think it's a very interesting point in that very few people outside America really understand the importance of the Supreme Court. They don't focus on it. They don't really see what it does. They don't understand the role it plays in fashioning the politics of today mm-hmm. and in changing the direction of how legislation goes. So outsiders are really not very interested in the Supreme Court. I mean, it is a thing of great importance, and I agree entirely that it is a very key decision, because at the moment the Supreme Court is split 50-50, largely into the so-called liberals and so-called conservatives, and therefore whoever is appointed will tip the balance one way or the other, and that affects legislation. But for outsiders, it's a complete mystery.
Why do you think that is, Geoffrey? I mean, do you agree with Michael on that?
Well, it's the American system. You know, the American system of checks and balances gives the Supreme Court so much power in defining the law. And the Constitution is such a sacred document. Unlike British parliamentary democracy in Canada, where I'm from where traditionally, you know, precedent and past laws have defined what is done in the future, there is this document, this sacred, holy text in America. And the Supreme Court, it is on their shoulders to determine how it is to be interpreted as times change. I think one of the interesting things, as Michael alluded to, we have 9 seats in the Supreme Court, including Chief Justice Roberts. Until this weekend, there were 5 conservatives, one of whom, Justice Kennedy, was a swing conservative. So some movements, some decisions went to the liberal minority of 4, sometimes had 5 with Kennedy. In the case of gay marriage, it was Roberts who also sided with them. But generally, this is a conservative court, which, of course, makes conservatives and Republicans gleeful. And the notion that Obama would choose someone who is liberal and change the very, very doctrine of American politics, American values at this late stage in his presidency is just anathema. And to be clear, there are key decisions on abortion, on contraception, on unions, all pending in the coming months. With a 4-4 court, which we now have, in a tie, it means that the lower court decision is upheld but does not become law across the land. So it's a state of paralysis. Liberals are mildly gleeful because it means Scalia cannot impose the conservative majority on these decisions, but that's only a temporary fix.
Michael, it's understandable then, given the context which Jeffrey describes there, that the Republicans are seeking to, heavily imply or suggest that there's, no historical precedence for Obama to make this appointment. That's obviously been picked apart somewhat. I mean, presumably the constitutional responsibility that Obama has is clear, and his right to name someone to this role is there for all to see.
Yes, of course it is. And it's absolute nonsense to say that that this is somehow going against the trend of the Constitution to nominate someone in your final year in power. It doesn't matter when you're, if you're president, you have that right. And there is the right to nominate the right person that you think will uphold the principles of the Constitution. Of course, presidents do try to stack the court with people they feel will follow broadly their own political philosophy. But they are obliged still to look for people who are absolutely the best qualified. And of course, there are always several of those.
You know, one of the interesting things, you can study the American Supreme Court and it is always fascinating to try to understand it. There are two disparate views of the court. One is that that law is an evolving, living, breathing organism. And the other is that it is frozen in what's called originalism. Scalia was the proponent of originalism. That is, what did they mean back in the 18th century when they wrote this document? Because that's what we should do today. It was a very, very rigid view of the way society is and the way things were intended to be. Most people would say, in fact, most justices would say, no, the Constitution is a living, breathing document and it has to be applied within the context of today. And what is so interesting about this Republican argument that Obama has no right to do this is that, in fact, if you apply originalism, it was simply a courtesy to the Senate back 200 years ago that they would validate the qualifications of a presidential nominee. It was not, the scrutiny only happened in the last couple of decades, and it only became nasty when Judge Bork was nominated in the 1980s by Ronald Reagan and refused because he was seen to be too ideological. That was the beginning of the era we're in now. But let's be clear, the Republicans are saying there's no precedent. There darn well is. Justice Anthony Kennedy was confirmed by a Democratic Senate in an election year by Ronald Reagan in 1988. Same scenario exactly.
And there's a couple of instances where someone hasn't been named in exactly the conventional way, but it's usually been because of other suggestions of, political complexity, other very particular reasons. Just to pick up, Michael, on that point that Jeffrey makes there about sort of originalism, do you think that there will be any traction then for the Republicans if they do try and use this rubber stamp instead as a more aggressive form of scrutiny?
Well,
it's understandable why they might, but
yes.
Is it going to go anywhere?
It could simply paralyze the Senate. I mean, they could hold things up, and that's the problem. The Republicans are in sort of last-ditch mode and have been for the past 5 or 6 years, basically trying to sabotage virtually anything that the president puts forward because they just hate the president. And therefore, whether it's in the interest of the nation or of the world or whatever it is, if it comes from the White House, they will try to sabotage it. And that is the problem. So we'll have to see.
And it's not without risk for the Republicans, because what this does is it actually changes the tone of this election in a very important way, because now, depending on your values about contraception, abortion, unions, and so many other key issues, this really is an ideological election. It's not just about rhetoric and demagoguery. And so if they play this wrong, the Republicans could galvanize the unions, women, minorities, et cetera, and young people to vote because so much is now at stake. Because clearly, if Trump or Cruz become president, or even Rubio or Bush, you're going to see a very conservative justice put in, and this court is going to uphold all sorts of conservative decisions. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the reasons we see this polarization is because the Supreme Court upheld a case called Citizens United, which allows unlimited cash into election campaigns. And that was the conservative majority pushing its conservative agenda, saying that's just kind of freedom of speech, throw the bucks. And so you have something like 135 families, according to the New York Times, giving half of the money for this election campaign for the Republicans.
Sobering number. Do you think, Jeffrey, just on that point, might Obama try and play a bit of a political strategy game here? Can he make a nomination that maybe is, you know, a younger, a more liberal candidate, but maybe is a Hispanic justice, something like this, and try and almost dare the Republicans to try and resist it? Could that be?
You're close. There is a leading candidate. His name is Srinivasan. He's a 48-year-old justice in the Federal Court of Appeals in Washington. He was approved by the Senate 97-0 in 2013. The same Republicans voted for him. He was in the Bush Justice Department. He has impeccable credentials. There's just no way you can argue this man is not qualified to be on the court. He plays a bipartisan role. The problem is that bipartisan doesn't cut it anymore. You're not an arch conservative. You're not good enough.
Michael, the other thing I just want to ask you about, a lot of the sort of the obituaries and in some cases eulogies about Scalia were talking about actually his deep held conviction that the original document was something to uphold, and the originalism that Jeffrey was describing. And it's interesting that even some liberal commentators, or maybe we imagine they're Democrat voters or sympathisers, have said, say what you like about Scalia, but this was a great legal mind, and his defences of some of those principles were very erudite and very impressive. Does that speak, do you think, to some kind of inner, inherently more sort of conservative mindset that sits actually with more American people than we might suspect?
Yes. I mean, he certainly was a person of great erudition and a person who interpreted what he saw, and a man of great conviction. I mean, conviction politics is a very important factor. He was admired because he was seen to be consistent with his own views and played them out, even if people didn't really like his interpretation. I mean, there's a very strange parallel with all of this in a completely different field where a big debate is going on right now, and that is in Islam, where there is a big debate as to whether it is permitted to interpret the Quran and the Hadith in the way that the Supreme Court interprets the American Constitution for conditions for today. And in Islam, it is actually now forbidden and has been ever since about the 12th century. But there's a big debate as to whether, along the analogy of the Supreme Court, people should say that the teachings in the Quran should be applied to today's conditions, and let's look at what those teachings are in their original form. And it's a sort of interesting reflection of these two debates going on in two very important areas of the world.
Just on that point then, Jeffrey, this idea of originalism, and that's interesting, that comparison with Islam. Is there any appetite in the US to have that discussion specifically, almost without politics, and say, look, what should we be looking to the Constitution to do?
I think that's pushing it. It's a very intellectual debate. I agree with Michael.
There can be popular appetite for intellectual debates.
The interesting thing, whatever your politics are, and you alluded to this, is that Scalia was a very, very smart man, smarter than pretty much every candidate running for the Republican nomination. Whether or not you agree with Scalia, he was smart. He was also, I think, disarmingly funny, which is a very powerful weapon when you're sitting on the bench. And he asked searing questions, and he was actually quite withering in his dissents when, for example, the gay marriage ruling was handed down with Chief Justice Roberts' support. He was absolutely withering of the majority. He had that intellectual ability. I think the idea of originalism is not... I think it's more prevalent in Christianity and Islam in certain sectors than it is on the court. I think the bigger issue is that we are facing an extraordinary deadlock in the nomination, and which can lead to a paralysis, and I think can lead to consequences which we are not qualified to predict. It is really... This is a huge turn in the American election, and it makes this election, which had so much at stake, even more important.
Well, that leads us on to what I wanted to ask you both about next, which was we've seen Donald Trump throwing the Iraq War, 9/11 in the face of Jeb Bush, suggestions that it proves his unsuitability for office because of his connections with W. Trump's delivery was predictably greeted with sort of jeers in some quarters, one imagines sort of some endorsement in others. Where are we at, do you think, Michael, with how Jeb Bush positions himself vis-a-vis his brother, and I guess to a lesser extent his father? It seems the plan to be, you know, his own man has been abandoned somewhat,
yes,
maybe understandably.
Particularly in view of what Trump is doing, because if Trump gets away with this, then absolutely nothing will stop him. Because quite honestly, George W. Bush is still revered very much in a large number of Republican circles, especially the military, even though there have been second thoughts perhaps about the Iraq war. The fact is, he is a man who was seen to have taken decisions that mattered, that were important. And if Trump badmouths him in South Carolina, of all places, where there's a strong military constituency, then, first of all, Jeb's best tactic is to come to the defense of his brother. And secondly, the best tactic is to make it look as though Trump is really rubbishing his own party and his own party's history. And therefore, for Jeb, it is quite useful now to come to the fact that, you know, he may be my brother, but he was also a great president.
There's an Orwellian doublespeak about Trump that comes out here that is, I find it chilling. You know, he is the definition of a demagogue. He is telling lies as if they are truths. He is claiming that he was against the Iraq war. And journalists have looked into this in detail. And he never spoke out against the Iraq war before it happened. He says he did. And it's becoming this truth. And this is the way he campaigns.
But why,
say
I
it
wonder,
enough,
why, Jeff, why,
and people
why
will
are these
believe
things
it.
Not wrong-footing him? Because as you rightly say, people have always long, you know, trawled through the record and found these hypocrisies and exposed them. But it never seems to upset his momentum.
The notion of Teflon understates this man. His ability to voice anger, his demagoguery, his ignorance, his lack of understanding of the issues, it makes him into an everyman. My mind's made up. Don't confuse me with facts. And there are no facts in his arsenal.
So if we turn back to the sort of the Bush dynasty, I guess, Michael, you call it, do you think that Jeb has, or the family more broadly, have they mismanaged the Bush political legacy?
Well,
should he have tried to make it a stronger suit, perhaps?
Possibly, but it's a bit late for him to come through now. I mean, he had the largest campaign chest, he raised the most money, and then he flopped. He's not terribly good in knockabout television debate. He's not got that demagogic touch, which is probably makes him a more serious candidate and possibly a more thoughtful man. But it doesn't play so well on television, and of course that's where the debates are held and where a lot of the votes are decided. And because he didn't get off to a flying start, he's now thought to be limping and trying to catch up. And it is coming through a bit late. Identifying with the other two Bushes, the other two presidents, was thought to be a risky strategy at the start because a lot of people still feel that Iraq didn't go the way it should have gone, and that is very identified with certainly the second Bush. So that's why he held back, and he wanted to be seen as his own man. Well, I think he's slightly clutching at whatever will give him traction now.
I think you're right. I think it's a move of desperation. And I think that had he had some traction earlier, he wouldn't be doing this. And to be clear, George W. Bush is still a very polarizing character. 67% of Republicans still revere him, according to a CBS poll. But a New York Times poll say that only 29% of Americans think he was a good president. That is a very low approval rating. You don't bring out 29 unless you're really desperate. And his brother Jeb is really caught. He needs love fast. South Carolina is a place where his brother was able, where the Bushes generally have had a strong following, and he's hoping that his brother can help him. But yes, I think this is an act of desperation. But really, this number three role is so critical as we watch this race. We've got only three serious contenders for it. We've got John Kasich, we've got Marco Rubio, and we've got Jeb Bush. Rubio, I think, is the walking wounded after his disastrous debate 10 days ago. He just made a fool of himself. All of the concern that he was a lightweight came through when he repeated those rehearsed lines over and over. Bush does have a chance to get that number three spot, and that could potentially allow him to go up the middle between Cruz and Trump. Somebody's going to get landed, and he's desperately trying to be the one.
Just on the foreign policy basis, and we've talked about this, obviously it's typical Trumpian bombast. It's really about point scoring. He's not talking about the future of, you know, the Middle East, or the past, indeed, for that matter. Does it worry you, Michael, if we look to, you know, whoever the GOP candidate ends up being, that there isn't a discussion about foreign policy, that there is, as Jeffrey mentioned, there's so much ignorance. These things are just being used as point scoring exercises. Does it worry you, you know, where a potential Republican White House might be going in terms of foreign policy post 2016.
Well, I have to say I've heard exactly the same worries expressed before almost every election in the US, because foreign
doesn't
policy...
It seems surely worse than it's been for a while.
But everybody says it's always... I mean, they said the same about Reagan. They said he knew absolutely nothing about what was going on overseas, and what he did know was simply a kind of cliches about the evil empire and all that sort of thing. People can learn in office, and they do have advisors, and the realities of office does tend to produce a more sober policy, or sometimes it does, and one hopes it will. It's true, there is a competition to display the greatest ignorance, but I have to say, it's not just in America, it's in almost all countries. Foreign policy is not an election issue, unless things go very, very wrong. Perhaps Iraq was before, when things were not going well. It's only when something goes disastrously wrong that foreign policy plays a role. Otherwise, people are much more interested in jobs and wages and opportunities and domestic concerns.
And we're going to be talking about some of those, and how they may affect us here in the UK in relation to the European Union in a moment when Michael Binion and Jeffrey Kaufman continue as my guests here on Midori House.
The Big Interview, the show that brings you the fascinating life stories of some of the most influential people in the world of art and culture, business and politics, continues this week with architect Kevin Roche.
Inevitably, in all buildings, in all projects, you expect the unexpected, because it always happens. Something that you never thought about, some absurdity of some sort, always comes up, and you're stuck with trying to solve that problem.
The 93-year-old Pritzker Prize winner Kevin Roche sits down with Steve Bloomfield to discuss the early mistakes and invaluable lessons of his youth, his work with some of the greatest architects, and the inherent value and purpose of architecture.
It has to be, and it should be, a commitment on the part of the individual to devote their lives to trying to improve in some way the built environment.
The Big Interview with Kevin Roche, download it now at monocle.com.
Past 1:22. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. Michael Binion and Jeffrey Kaufman are with me. Now, for a while, it seemed likely that, if anything, we're going to throw a spanner in the mechanics of the European Union as we know it. It might be the Greek finances or the refugee crisis, but the spanner may actually be thrown by the United Kingdom. After all, the question of whether Britain will remain in the Union will be centre stage this week as EU leaders meet. Prime Minister David Cameron's committing to holding a referendum by the end of next year. One assumes that leaders will be doing their best to convince Britain to stay this week. Michael, is that what will be on the agenda, do you think?
Up to a point, they don't want Britain to leave, that's for sure, but they're not going to make concessions that they think will come back to haunt them, and they're not going to make special exceptions for Britain, because they know that other countries will demand the same treatment. Mm. And they sort of say, well, if you're in the club, you obey by the rules. Yes, they'll bend the rules a little bit to try to make cosmetic differences that could help Cameron, and he desperately needs some cosmetic differences, because of cosmetic adjustments. The problem is, of course, that these will be exposed by his own enemies in his own party, who say, you've brought nothing back that's substantial, it's not going to make any difference, and the civil war in the Conservative Party will go on as it has before.
Jeffrey, what do you think that the EU mindset is here? Is Michael right that there's a fear, an understandable fear, of a full kind of existential crisis for the bloc if Britain does elect to leave in the next two years or so?
You know, I think three former British ambassadors to Germany had a very different view. They said that if Britain leaves, Germany will aggressively fight for the wealth of the city. And for those who don't know what that is a reference to, the city is the financial district here in London, London's Wall Street, where billions and billions of dollars, pounds, yen, euro go through each year, and really is the engine of growth of the British economy in many ways. And there was a time when the Germans believed that Frankfurt would win that prize, probably about two decades ago. And London snagged it, and really, along with Wall Street and Hong Kong, you know, those are the three financial centers in the world. If Britain leaves, it will be open season on that, according to the three British ambassadors, mm-hmm. former British ambassadors to Germany. I think, though, it's fair to say a lot of countries are very nervous about it. It is a lose-lose if the Brexit, so to speak, as it's called, the British exit, everything has to have a cute acronym, if the Brexit happens. I just scratch my head and think, David Cameron, what kind of leader are you to have boxed yourself in like this? This is just a cataclysmic. To have made a promise to hold a referendum, he was scared by Nigel Farage and by the UK Independence Party in the last election. He thought he could promise his way out of it. Farage did dismally in the election, and now he's got to live up to a promise that I've got to believe he wishes he never made.
Is this an example, would you go along with that, Michael, of political short-sightedness or a misguided...
Well, absolutely. I mean, the calculation as to how you can outsmart your rivals usually lands you with things that come back to haunt you. Mm. And I think this is a clear case of that having been the case. The problem is, though, that the issue of Europe is toxic for the Conservative Party and has been for a very long time. And to try to get the Conservatives in a kind of friendly, let's give Europe another chance mood is almost impossible. The appeal of let's just take some decisive action and do something bold and different and solve it. And unfortunately, that appeal is very widespread among the British public because they think that all our present travails, either with the economy or with bureaucracy or particularly with immigration, it's the big thing that is worrying people, will be solved in a flash just by pulling out and saying, you solve your own problems, we're on our own. You know, that kind of wartime spirit, let's do it alone. Mm. Well, it's not going to work, but it's very difficult for Cameron to say, let's stay in, because it doesn't sound very adventurous, and let's stay in with some concessions. He's really up against it.
Just a final thought on this, Geoffrey. It's interesting you mentioned that idea about the City of London, and it was thinking back to the Scottish independence vote, it seemed that money ultimately spoke loudest. It scared people at the end. There was a perception, rightly or wrongly, that it would cost Scotland, and maybe given subsequently collapsing oil prices, that was proven to be right. Will that win the day here? Do you think that the big fear about, Frankfurt taking over the City of London, for want of a better expression, will be enough to persuade people?
Do you want me to tell you who's going to win the horse races
tomorrow? I was asking you for a guess. Yeah.
I think that the problem for Cameron is he went in with an agenda and he's not going to get a solid list of wins the way he promised. He'll get some concessions. He can say, listen, in a world of compromise, we did okay. Common sense says you're right. But these are not necessarily common sense votes. And if emotion can be injected into this, then it becomes a personal issue. And I think Michael's right. You living in London, the issue of immigration in certain quarters, I don't think universally at all, is particularly though in working class rural areas, northern areas, is a really big issue. And there's a lot of fear. This country's, 60 million? Somebody said to me that in the next 20, 30 years, 40 years, it'll be 100 million. You're seeing, this is where the jobs are. The English language is the global language. You're seeing people, I joke that, when you go to a restaurant, for listeners who aren't in London, when you go to a coffee shop, a Costa or Starbucks, when you go to a restaurant, you almost never have a British server in this country now. You know, the entry-level job for Spaniards, for Italians, for Lithuanians, for Romanians is that. And that is just the complexion. I think it's what makes London a terrific place to live. I'm going to declare my cards. I think it's what makes this a terrific global city. But I have to be honest, there are a lot of people in this country who disagree with me.
Michael, maybe last word to you on this. What do you think might happen? What wins the day? Do people have that nice cosmopolitan worldview that Geoffrey has?
Well, I think two things win the day. One is the fear factor, as you mentioned. Actually, we may be better off. Let's not jump outside what we know. And if the pro-Europeans can play this hard enough and ruthlessly enough, this will cost you jobs, this will cost you the economy, that might swing the day. I also think the danger is any referendum, people find it a good chance to stick two fingers up at the government. It's a chance to say, whatever you ask us, the answer's no, because we don't like you and we're fed up with you, and it's like a mini general election.
Isn't there also, though, a danger that this will divide the Conservative Party?
Oh, that's the danger right from the beginning. The Conservative Party will split almost fatally. That's always been the danger.
And just to go back, Tom, not to, I know you've got an agenda there, but what's interesting, that parallel with what we were talking about before the break, a Trump or Cruz candidacy could, across the pond, split the Republican Party. That's a very real scenario being talked about.
Schisms on the right, always fascinating to discuss. So with you both, gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us. That's Jeffrey Kaufman and Michael Binion, my guests here on Midori House. That's all we have time for. Thanks to our producer, Ben Rylan, and our studio manager, Chris Chilvers. Tune in at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London. Don't miss it. Goodbye.